our guest speaker, Dr. Bill Cottrell. He is married. His wife's name is Jane, and they have three children, two boys and a girl. He has two grandchildren. One is a little girl named Emily, and he had a little grandson last week named Zachary, so he seemed very proud of him on the phone today. He was an OBGYN and fertility doctor in Dallas in 1980 and practiced there until he came here to Louisville about 3 years ago. He volunteers here in Louisville at the Crisis Pregnancy Center, and he is also at the seminary, the Gaines Professor of Christian Ministry. He teaches several other classes here. One is the Marriage Enrichment class, and it is offered on Tuesday night. I've heard a lot of great things about that. You come with your husband, you and your husband come together, so that's a great time to talk about your marriage, and he teaches that on Tuesday night, and from what he has told me, he thinks that's going to be an ongoing class, so if some of you and your husbands are interested in that, I think I would highly recommend that to you. We just are glad to have him here tonight. He took time out of his class to come and speak with us, so we're thankful for that. We're excited about the informative information he's going to bring us, and we hope that you enjoy it. Dr. Cottrell.
Thank you very much. Is the mic working well? I can hear it reverbing. Thank you, gentlemen. It is a pleasure to be here. The marriage enrichment class even now is in the midst of a communication exercise, which is a lot of fun. They divvy up and have to learn how to speak and listen well, which is a skill many do not have. So I'm thrilled to change hats from professor back to obstetrician for the evening to talk about preventive health care. God has been very good in the many privileges I've had to serve in different ways. I love OB-GYN. It was a great lifestyle. Okay, maybe the lifestyle wasn't, but it was really exciting to be part of all of the births. But open heart surgery sort of slowed me down some, so I'm now in semi-retirement and keep my license up so I can volunteer at the pregnancy center, do the sonograms. But those women are obviously a crisis time in their life, and it's nice to be able to be part of that. This is a whole different deal tonight as we talk about preventative medicine. I'm going to try to convince you that there are some things that you can do to live well and likely live longer. Some of them are simple, some of them are a little intimidating, but let me encourage you to consider the health issues. I decided a little Old Testament blessing or cursing might set the right mood, because many of you, when it's time to go for your appointment and hear those words, those magical words, scoot on down the table. It elevates your heart rate and all, I understand. But there is some valuable information that can save your life. I'll tell you at the front, I am biased, all right? Totally biased. Not only as a trained physician, but my wife's a breast cancer survivor. And she's 5 years out now, and when we found it on routine mammogram. Even when I knew where it was, I couldn't feel it. And as a skilled and trained physician, that's scary, because I would have thought I could find anything. But the fact is, we can find them now with skilled mammography 6 months to a year before they're big enough to feel. So depending on your history and a lot of other issues, we're going to talk about those things. It's not boilerplate. Everybody needs the same thing at the same time because you come with different histories, different family histories, different habits, different genetics. So what's appropriate for you may not be what's the right course of action for the person sitting next to you. But there are some things that are so simple that I want to encourage you to take advantage of, because they can show up in a family with no family history. Ah, Ms. Magnuson, now, I have been told by your husband that I have to perform my uterus impersonation, so I will do that later for your benefit. It's become fairly famous here on campus. Okay, maybe not, infamous. But as you think about yourselves tonight, and I want us to have a good time, this is your time, and I'd like to try to leave a little time at the end for questions, because I get questions through email on phone all the time here on campus, and I believe that's part of the reason God brought me here. And obviously, I don't know as much about you as your physician does, so I don't second-guess them. But when you ask sort of broad-spectrum questions about screening or what tests are, I don't mind helping with that. But we're complex individuals, and health includes all of those things, and health impacts all of those things. So when we think in terms of wellness, we're beyond just not being sick. There are not only the physical issues, most of what we talk about tonight will pertain to the physical issues. But there's also the intellectual issues, which you are having stimulated both in your studies and those of you with spouses that are attending here, those of you that are attending here are getting hopefully some intellectual stimulation. Emotional issues, in the marriage enrichment classes, we're trying to communicate to some of our husbands that those are legitimate needs and those are reasonable to understand. And then, of course, the spiritual issues. So we're going to look beyond just, I'm not sick, so I'm okay, to there's a different level of just not being sick. There is above that a functioning wellness. And some of these preventative things can keep you there. Ah, the balloon's getting in someone's way. All right, now, I am a compartmental, typical XY male kind of thinker. So I think in categories. And when there are problems or issues to investigate, I think in terms of these sort of ranges. We're not going to talk about puberty tonight. I look around. I think most of us have made that. Praise God. So we're going to move right to maturity. We won't have much time to talk about fertility, infertility, though that was about a third of my practice. Love to work through it because God has given us some real insight into that. In the last couple of decades, there are some things that are available. That doesn't mean everyone has to proceed with them, but it's good to understand the complexity of our reproductive capacity. The perimenopause and menopause are fascinating times of life. I don't think I'll spend a lot of time there, but it's important to understand that God has designed you for change. As I try to talk to husbands, when you marry a woman who is constantly changing. Hormones change, and as the ages unfold, you change. And that's by divine design. And we need to appreciate that, but also recognize that those major life changes have some health impact. And there are some things to be watching for as these different changes occur. This is sort of the pep talk at the beginning. There's a lot we can do about lifestyle that will change, impact death rate. You see the little paragraph at the bottom. 2/3 of premature deaths are due to some of these things. Now, I know you read smoking and excessive drinking, figure, hey, well, we're pretty safe there. But then you get to diet and exercise and some of those issues, and we can all stand to be reminded. Because it's easy to get out of that mode when you get in seminary mode and baby mode to sort of forget to take care of the vessel that God gave you. The only one you're going to have until our regenerated body is suited for eternity. So take care of that one, and we're going to look at some of the ways to take care of them. The leading causes are still in the heart disease and then cancer, some vascular kinds of things. Depending on age group, some other things are issues. But I decided that tonight I'd try to pick the highlights of in women's health and hope that I guessed what you wanted to hear about, and if not, you can ask. Obviously, we can screen for lots of things. Some of these are so simple that you ought to all be screened, and we have the capability to do some tonight, right? Okay, they didn't really, not enthusiastic about that, but we have some, our medical staff is here. We have a clinic here on campus that I'm really excited about. Blood pressure screening doesn't hurt. This you need to know. Now, if you're 20 and your blood pressure is normal, great. But again, at 25 and 30, if you got zero family history, still worth checking, easy to do. They've got home kits now. You can plug up at Kroger's and get your blood pressure checked. And just because it's bad once doesn't mean you're hypertensive, okay? But neither does it just because it's good once mean you never have to worry about it again. Blood pressure changes almost with each heartbeat, but it stays in a range. And there's a normal range, which you would love to be in. And I've had patients call worried that their blood pressure was too low. Well, if you can stand up without passing out, it's not too low. Statistically, you're better off to have 100 over 60 than 120 over 80. But 120 over 80 is fine. Used to be that 140 over 90 was the cutoff for abnormality, but even the 130s is the top number, and the high 80s is the bottom number, may be significant and should be followed up. These are easy things to keep track of, and sometimes very easy things to correct. Diet, exercise, salt modification can be the answer for some people, and others with a genetic background may wind up on fairly strenuous exercise regimens and very specific medication. We can test your blood for lots of things, all sorts of things, but some tests are particularly valuable. If your family history, there's a lot of heart disease, a lot of high blood pressure, then the cholesterol triglycerol screening can be helpful. We know now it's more than just your cholesterol number because there's little kinds of cholesterol, kind of the good kind and the bad kind, and if they're out of balance, it increases your risk, or if they're in a better balance, it may decrease your risk. Probably worth checking somewhere in your 20s just to see. And if you have a family history of heart disease or arteriosclerosis, what's called hardening of the arteries, those kind of issues, that screen makes good sense for you. Some of you, I hope, go for an annual exam, and some of you, your annual exam happens every other year, I understand. But there are some valuable things that can be gathered there. Sometimes we do a blood count and blood chemistry to look for things that are as simple as anemia, because women tend to be anemic, particularly if the periods are close together or heavy. And that can make you tired, susceptible to illness, and all sorts of things, and it's fairly easy to treat in most cases. The blood chemistries can tell us how your liver's working, how your kidneys are working, and give us a clue if something is out of balance. Not necessary for everybody, but if there's something where you're not feeling right, these are the kind of simple screens that narrow the horizon for us to try to help us as physicians and nursing staff to get an idea what's going on. Who needs to be in the hospital and get worked up, and who's got the flu and just needs fluids and rest. Glucose I put on here because it's a screen that is easy to do. Probably all of us should have it. If you are pregnant, considering pregnancy, that's a test that they need to do, because pregnancy stresses everything from your hair to your toenails. But if you are sort of prone to blood sugar problems, diabetes, it will often show up then. And so they'll be screening to look for it. Colon cancer is not common in the younger age groups, but in our country it is quite common as we get older. And it's fairly simple to screen for, looking for blood in the colon, blood in the stool. That can be done at the annual exam. I put these others on there so that we don't forget, just because I'm a gynecologist, I recognize that the world doesn't revolve around, you know, those particular sort of organs, but that in fact, hair, teeth and eyes and skin, there's a lot of issues that can be easily checked and screened for. And then we'll talk about GYN health, because I assume that's why I was invited. Maybe not, huh? Okay, well, we'll talk about something else. Would you like to talk about my grandson? I should have scanned a picture in. We could do that. So this is kind of the overall game plan. I switched it, figuring where the interest might be, and then I decided to put breast cancer up because I'm not leaving without talking about that. Obviously, it's a personal issue to me. But as a gynecologist, so many of these things, there isn't a cancer that does better if you wait longer. All right? They all do better the earlier you find them. And the earlier you get to them, the better the survival rates. And cure rate, the way we use it, is a five-year-out survival with no recurrence. That's a good thing. And all of these things that we'll look at have stages. And the farther the stage, the worse the prognosis or the worse the future looks. And that doesn't mean God can't change things, and has. But I also think that prudence would suggest that there's some things that we can do. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight, some of the preventive things. High blood pressure, the silent killer. We've talked briefly about getting it checked. It's very common. Now, what are the symptoms of early blood pressure problems? That's right. There really aren't any. If you're waiting for headaches and nosebleeds and dizziness, you're probably waiting too long. I had a man come to the emergency room with a 300 over 180, which is staggering. I mean, the top of his head should have shot off, but it didn't, or nosebleeds. Most of the folks that you know that have nosebleed, their blood pressure is perfectly fine. But this one is easy to check. It's really inexcusable to not know that your blood pressure is normal, borderline, or high. If it's high, you should be treated. If it's borderline, it should be followed. And if it's low, then it should be checked at regular intervals. But don't let blood pressure do you in. And ask in your family, has anybody got, in the old days they called it the high blood. Well, that's fine. If that's what's there, then check yourself, because there are some things you can do that can make a difference. Obviously, it tends to get higher as we get older. You know, there's hardly anything that gets better as we get older. I'm learning that firsthand, and while if there was a place to complain, I might. But the whole consequences of sin and our deterioration is becoming more and more evident. Lots of statistics are gathered, so we know that the African-American race has a higher risk of hypertension, of blood pressure problems, than Caucasian and Asian. Does that mean Caucasian and Asian shouldn't get checked? No. Just means that the risk factors are such that if you're in the African-American racial makeup, you ought to be checked often, early. And if you go to one of the Kroger's and you hook up for your quarter and it checks and it comes out some strange number, sometimes the machines are whacked, okay? So get checked with a real live person that's really pumping it up. We're really using the new electronic stuff, can watch it, can recheck it, can let you lay down a few minutes, check it again, stand you up, check it again. And so if they're going to call it high, it's really high. You with me? Because one high level doesn't necessarily mean anything. As a matter of fact, if I were to take the blood pressure of every patient I saw the moment they walked in and saw me, or just saw my white coat, didn't even have to see me, just the coat, they'd all be high. Because of that adrenaline release, that sort of fight or flight fear thing, will jack up your blood pressure. That doesn't mean you need to be treated. It just means you need to sit around a little while and relax. Who has the higher blood pressure, men or women? Is this not an interactive group? Take a shot. It's a 50-50 deal. Okay, we got men and women. The right answer is yes. It depends on when during the age span. Men, we take the lead till after menopause, then women catch up and can go ahead, all right? But yeah, there's some advantages to that estrogen. There are some disadvantages as well, but there's some help. A family history of high blood pressure is significant. If both your parents and uncles and aunts and everybody's on medicine for blood pressure, then you need to get checked in your 20s, 25, 30, and just keep an eye on it. It may never go up. If you stay fit and take care of yourself, you may never have blood pressure problems. But you may do all that and still have blood pressure problems if you got the bad genetics. Some of that you can't help. I know you love your family, but they've given you some genes that you're just going to have to deal with. Now, there's some things you can manage. Obviously, obesity doesn't help anything. So you'll see it on most of the lists. Activity level. That's a real surprise, isn't it? Your body was not made to sit on the sofa. I give this lecture to myself, too, because I really enjoy my sofa, but it's not what you need. There was a lovely study out of the aerobic center down in Dallas. Anyone ever heard of Ken Cooper? Okay, he's the aerobics guru, and down in Dallas, the research that he showed is if you are active 5 or 6 days a week, and that can be walking, that you can achieve a level of cardiovascular fitness that will help your heart, help your vessels. So that means walk if you like to walk. Walk your dog. Park at the mall away from instead of driving 30 minutes to get the close spot. And walk in. Get in the mall, walk around the mall. You and your heart will benefit. It will do great things for you. Be active. And if you like a sport, that's great. But do one that you enjoy and can do over the lifespan. Tobacco, shouldn't have to say much about it, except we are in Kentucky, which is one of the places where you can't badmouth tobacco. But let me say, it doesn't do anything good for you either. It has a myriad of effects, and all of them are bad. Enough said? Okay, salt. Now, too much, particularly for a hypertensive person, makes it worse. Because with the salt, your body will hold on to water to equalize it. Now, if your kidneys are normal, you'll get rid of most of it, and it won't cause an issue. But if you're kind of one of those borderline people, your salt intake, which would mean the pizza, the chips, all the really good stuff, may have to be limited. I never tell anybody to eliminate those things because then it doesn't really seem like fun. But sometimes it has to be lowered, and for some fairly drastically. Alcohol, once again, doesn't have any great health benefits. There are a few things that it helps. There's one study that showed that wine in Europe, those folks had lower heart attack rates. But I'm guessing that Dr. Mueller wouldn't enjoy that if I were to start recommending it. So let's just say that as a general rule, avoid it, all right? Although I guess you can have the Baptist alcohol, which is NyQuil. You do know that's 25%. Okay, and stress. Is there anyone here that's under stress? Okay, no. Well, for that one person, praise God. But for the rest of us, realize that that causes that adrenaline release and will elevate your blood pressure. So it's a matter of knowing how to manage stress and control stress. And you know what? Activity does that. Exercise will help with that. There are other things, and maybe someday we'll do a stress workshop. But if hypertension is the issue, there's a few of these things that you can take care of that will actually help and give you statistically a longer lifespan. Now, when you go see the doc, he should take a good history of all things, but he should ask about family history of blood pressure, or if you've had an elevated blood pressure, or if your blood pressure was elevated during a pregnancy. All of those things are significant. A good examination, because high blood pressure can come from kidney disease, believe it or not. A lot of things can contribute to it. And if your blood pressure is high, they'll probably want to do a cardiogram to see how your heart is handling it. Because if your heart has to work under that pressure for a long period of time, the muscles will actually get bigger for a while, and then they may actually get weaker and be more at risk to problems. There's lots of ways to check for the different issues. Sonogram, MRIs, those are looking for the kind of tumors that can secrete the hormones that make your blood pressure go up. An adrenal cancer, a kidney tumor can cause blood pressure problems. So if it's up, don't be surprised if the doctor wants to do a few tests to find out why. And when he can't, and in over 80% of the time there isn't any particular reason, then he'll do the diet modification, the exercise mod, and maybe put you on some medication. Because we know statistically, your life will be fuller and longer if your blood pressure's in the normal range. And most of those medicines are pretty reasonable. There's not a lot of side effect. All right, well, as promised, we're going to go to the gynecology part next. And my personal bias about breast cancer. It's a hard thing to watch somebody you love go through that. And I suspect some of you here have had that experience. But it does make me bold about saying how necessary it is to take care of yourself. Now, just because you find a lump, did you bring the breast to check with? Okay, good. Because you find a lump does not mean you have cancer, all right? Most of the lumps and bumps that you find will be perfectly benign. And in the 30 and eight under, it's like just a couple of percent that they'll be anything worrisome. But you should watch them. We want to talk about doing the self-breast exam, even though one study suggests it doesn't make a difference. I still believe it does, because you're going to find things sooner. But some of what you find is going to be benign, and that's okay. How many of you would be disappointed if the lump you found was not cancer? I don't think so. But there's a normal cyclicity in the breast as well as the ovaries. And so there can be some lumps and some cysts and some thickenings that you may find. As a matter of fact, what used to be called fibrocystic disease is now called fibrocystic change because 80% of women have it. So it's not really a disease, it's just a fairly common finding, which means as the hormones increase, the breast ducts thicken, you may feel a little cystic lumpiness, and it may even be tender. That can be scary. But if you watch it through the cycle and the period comes and it disappears and you can't find it anymore, that's fibrocystic change. Not cancer, tumors don't do that. But if you're concerned, and you're perfectly okay to be concerned, you can have the doc check. But what he'll probably do is say, come in after your period, because that's when the swelling from the hormones is mostly gone, and where if you find something, it would be more significant. Now, occasionally, these little benign cysts will last through a cycle, but not through the second one. So the way we follow them, if they're smooth and cystic, which is a sort of a soft, mushy feel, we may not do anything dramatic. If it's big enough, we may do an aspiration, try to drain the things, or we may do a mammogram or a sonogram. How old does a woman need to be for mammograms to be particularly accurate? This crowd is just, I need some life out there, help me. I'm one guy here, help me. Okay, now you see, most people think the mammograms are good anytime, but they're really not. In your 20s, the breasts are fairly dense, and it's easier to miss stuff than it is to find stuff. Does that mean you shouldn't do one? Well, it may not be the best test. If I have nothing else, I might do that. But a sonogram of the breast can show us whether it's a solid or a cystic mass, which is helpful. Because if it's cystic, the chances of it being a cancer are very remote. But it's not till your mid to late 30s that the mammogram really gets much better. And in the 40s, it's quite good. And 50 and up, it's very, very good. I mean, they can see stuff with great precision. I like the test. Obviously, in my opinion, it saved my wife's life because by the time I would have found it, which would have been another year later, it might have gone from the stage that it was to the next stage. And each stage up, the chances of successful treatment get less. Not zero, but less. There are lots of cases, and there are lots of different treatments. So that you know a lady who's had breast cancer and she had chemo, or she had radiation, or she had surgery, radiation, and chemo, but your friend didn't. Could be totally different tumors, and yet the approach can be absolutely correct and yet be that different. Not all breast cancers are the same. Some of them are hormone sensitive, some of them are not. So the treatment protocols would be different. Whether it's, I don't know if I put the different approaches up, but there are different surgical approaches as well as the chemo approaches. Now, I've never seen these signs in someone who wasn't advanced in disease, all right? So this isn't really what you're looking for. Most nipple discharge is perfectly benign. Many women on birth control pills have a nipple discharge. Many women who have husbands that spend a lot of time stimulating the nipples have a nipple discharge. Breastfeeding women, after they've quit breastfeeding, still often have a nipple discharge. But by itself, if it's there and it's persistent and it's spontaneous, usually means there's a hormone that's a little higher than it's supposed to be, not that there's a cancer. But if you find it, get a good opinion and figure out what it is. But these other kinds of signs, now a bloody discharge, even a bloody discharge is usually not cancer. It's usually trauma, something has injured the breast. Breastfeeding moms almost always have some blood, at least microscopically, because Junior has gotten a little aggressive here or there. But it's scary when you see the blood, or some moms first see the blood when the baby spits up, and they see the blood there and freak out. Many a nighttime phone call for that. Not usually the big issue, but retraction is when the nipple pulls back in when it shouldn't. And we're going to talk a little about how to do the exam, because you will be the best judge when there's change. That's what you're looking for, is change. Now, breasts change over time, particularly if you go on medications like birth control pills or other hormones or conceive, because pregnancy changes everything. But these are some signs that can be helpful. The change in contour and texture, let me try to explain that to you when we talk about how to do the thing. The fibrocystic changes I mentioned, totally benign. You know what a cyst is? We talk about them all the time. I teach in crisis class, and none of the guys know what a cyst is. So what is it? It's a... good deal. It's a fluid-filled sac. That's all it is. It can be benign. It can be malignant. It means nothing. They can be anywhere. You can have a cyst under your skin. You can have a cyst in the breast. You can have a cyst on the ovary. A cyst just means fluid-filled sac. Doesn't mean cancer. Doesn't mean anything. It just is a description. There are lots of cysts in the breast. Some of them can be milk-filled. Some of them serum-filled. If you've gotten bumped or banged, it can be blood-filled. None of that has anything to do with cancers, okay? Fibroadenoma is a hard lump in the breast, but it's totally benign. You can have them anywhere, but when they show up in the breast, it's a little scary. Infections, particularly nursing moms, we talked about, and trauma. The breast tissue is very delicate. The architecture is very fine, lace-like supports. And so women who exercise a lot and run or are traumatized by, you know, bump into something can cause some damage, some bruising, some swelling, and then you can get the lumpy feeling while the body's sort of clearing that out. Benign. 100-to-1, that's women to men. Men also have breast cancer, but rarely. It increases with age. The older the woman is, the more likely that she will develop breast cancer. And that's apart from the personal and family history. If you have first-order relatives, your mom, your mom's sisters, or your sisters with breast cancer, puts you in a risk category that you need to be followed closely. Doesn't mean you'll ever get it, but you need to be on the lookout. What's the risk of any woman developing breast cancer over the course of a lifetime? No history, just across the board. Am I just making this stuff up, or is this a serious issue? Okay, when I was in medical school, which was back in the days of the dinosaurs, it was the correct answer was 1 in 14. That was actually in the 70s. You know what the correct answer is now? It's between 8 and 9, depending on who you read. So how come so many? We don't know, but there's something, whether it's in the air, the food, or something. But the risk of breast cancer is increasing, and so we need to be on the lookout. There is a gene, there's actually two, that really significantly increases your risk. I wouldn't check for it unless you had a really positive family history. Then it might be worth the test. Because if it's positive, your risk is high enough that some doctors recommend a prophylactic mastectomies, meaning to just remove the breast surgically before you even get to the point of maybe having a suspicious lesion. That's dramatic, but breast cancer is serious business. Increased estrogen causes increased tumors. And increased weight, fatty tissue can turn hormones into estrogen. So fat can make the estrogen content higher than it would be ordinarily, and that increases the risk of breast disease. The self-exam. How often should you do it? Once a month. When should you do it? Yeah, the best time is the same time of the month of your cycle. If you don't have a real regular cycle and you want to use a calendar day, that's okay. But what's going to happen is some days that's going to show up in the middle of your cycle when you're lumpier and more sensitive than the first week following your period, where the estrogen level is lowest and you will be less likely to find troubling areas. So if you're a 28-day lady, then it's going to work pretty well. If you're 30 or 35, which is also normal, you might want to just figure out a way to remind yourself in that first week afterwards. Why the shower? Why did my wife put the pictures on? Why the shower? All right, well, I presume I didn't hear that, but it's probably just as well. What one of my patients told me was that at the best time, first of all, the water increases the sensitivity, so you're more likely to feel. Now, that also means you're more likely to feel normal stuff, but we'll take that. Plus, that my patient told me that she spends 3 minutes at least with the conditioner on her hair and has that 3 minutes to use. Well, great, if that's the way, because it'll take you a little bit of time. There's two important facets. One is in front of the mirror to examine the breast to see if there's asymmetry. There's always asymmetry. So what you need to know is what is your normal asymmetry so that if something starts to grow or pull in or pooch out, you notice a difference. And that means to see all the contours of the breast, you'll need to lift your arms and bend forward looking in the mirror. Now, I know this sounds ridiculous, but the doctor ought to do that too. Unfortunately, they're getting too fast and not doing what's important, because if you visually see an area that's tucked in or pooched out, then you ought to pursue it further. Then you want to examine the breast with the finger pads, not the tips, but the pads. Whether you go linear strips or circumferential doesn't matter as much as covering the whole breast. If you cover the whole breast, you've done well. And you need to cover in the armpits too, because the glands of the breast go up into the armpit, and you may find the lump up there. Where do the lymph nodes go from the breast? Trick question. Some go out to the armpit, some actually go in next to the sternum. The ones that go out this way, you sometimes can feel. If you get an injury on your hand, you may be able to feel those. But what you're looking for is something that's different, something that's thick, something that's bumpy, something that has an edge. And we have I'm told we have the practice breast here, and I suggest most women are skitsy about checking that. You want to know because when you feel this, you'll go, well, gee, I'd notice that. That's the point. You really would. But people don't check. And I suggest you actually put it on the chest so you have something to push against and not just try to hold it in two hands, because you don't get to do that, really. You want to sort of simulate what it's like. Now, the physician gets to use both hands so that we get a little better coverage that way. A physician exam that's done well takes a little bit of time, but it can be very helpful, particularly if you have found something. Tell them you found something, but don't tell them where. Make them find it. And then if he can't find it or she can't find it, then point to the spot, because he may have found it and it was just normal glands and it didn't get his attention. You with me? But he may find the really serious thing that's something else that you didn't find. So trust the experience of someone who's done a lot of them, but trust yourself. Once you know what's normal, you can say, oh, this wasn't there last month. I don't know what it is, but it wasn't there. Mammograms are, I think, appropriate. Any kind of a risk history, do them in the 30s, otherwise probably 40 is good. As insurance gets cheaper and cheaper, it's going to be harder and harder to get what you really need. My bias is I'm an advocate for mammography, obviously. And it's not the most comfortable test. There was a joke circulating around the campus, if you got email, with basically described the mammogram in very graphic and unkind terms. It's a bit uncomfortable, because to see the breast, they have to compress it. And so there are two plates that sort of flatten the breast out. But to get a good, clear reading is worth it. The sonogram, the sound waves looking for solid versus cystic. Biopsy, if we find something. A biopsy just means to take a piece of it. You can do that with a needle, or you can do that with some other kinds of instruments. So biopsy can be a very tiny, in the office, fairly painless, or it can be a surgical procedure where they go in and take a biopsy, take the whole lump or a major part of the lump out. And then once they find a lump that is cancer, they would want to know if it's sensitive to hormones or not in order to design your therapy. Now, for the sake of time, I'm going to kind of skip through these, but you've probably heard there's lots of different approaches. You can do breast conserving operations that just remove the lump or the tumor itself, and then various parts where the breast is removed, the breast and the lymph nodes are removed, the breast, the nodes, and the muscle are removed. They hardly ever do that one anymore, because statistically it doesn't do better than the folks that have the breast and a sampling of the lymph nodes, because then we know what to treat. We either need to radiate the chest wall or we don't. We need to do chemo or we don't, based on what kind of tumor it is. All right. Got to show one of these pictures just because, you know. But you would be amazed. I had a third-year female medical student that didn't understand the anatomy too well, so I'll just assume that it never hurts to remind you what we're checking when we're doing the exams. What is the pap smear check for? Cervical disease. That's right, cervical cancer. And where is the cervix? It's in there somewhere, right? Good. Okay. Does the pap smear check for uterine cancer? No, although if there's a significant cancer, sometimes we see it on the pap smear. How about ovarian cancer? Pap smear is no good for that. Now, I had a slide of how the pap smear is done, but it didn't take, which probably suits you all just fine. Here is the uterus, the fallopian tubes, and the ovaries, yes. Well, it helps when I'm trying to talk to the guys about where fertilization takes place, that they know where the eggs are, where the sperm meet them, and all that kind of stuff, all right? Now, the normal uterus does not have the fibroid tumor on the top. But this is helpful to know. Ovarian cancer is a big disease. Cervical cancer is significant and not uncommon. No one now should die from cervical cancer. Yet it'll happen because people won't get checked. This is a disease. Why is it called the pap smear? Because of Dr. Papanicolaou. Do you want to call in and ask for a Papanicolaou smear? No, you don't. So it's named for him. He figured out that if you take this, a little wooden stick in those days, now it's plastic, and scrape the cervix, put the cells on a slide, cancer looks different from normal. That's the pap smear. We take a little brush now and go inside the cervix because sometimes the cancer can be up in there. Again, put it on a slide, they look at it under the microscope, normal, cancer, look different. It's that simple. But it's not just normal or cancer, there's all those in-betweens. There's sometimes 3 to 5 years from normal to cancer where we can find it, treat it, cure it. That's why you have pap smears, to find it before it's a cancer. Because when it's dysplasia, which is a fine word that just means it ain't normal, but it ain't cancer, when it's that, it's treatable, it's curable. So we feel like as OB-GYNs, we've got a few years, because pap smears aren't perfect, sometimes they miss them, but if we're getting to see you every year or every other year, there's a very small likelihood that it'll get to cancer. We're going to find it before that, when it's eminently treatable. It's a very common cancer, most of the time related to human papillomavirus, which is a sexually transmitted disease. Unfortunately, it's way common. 80% of the female seniors graduating from, well, it was Stanford, since that's not in our state, were positive for HPV. Now, there's lots of HPV, and there's only two strands of it that are really connected with cervical cancer, but this is a biggie. So if you have sexual exposure in your past, or your spouse does, it's worth checking. Nuns who are virginal essentially never get cervical cancer. I'm not recommending that as a lifestyle, I'm just giving you the facts. The screening is very, very successful. I know nobody likes the pap smear, the little speculum thing that looks like a duck. It's just so we can see the cervix. And then we take the pap smear of it, and in a minute or less, we ought to have the sample. Now, sometimes it looks unusual, and you know to go further with the testing, but the pap smear has saved a myriad of lives. And while it is a tad uncomfortable, if you've ever been with somebody who is suffering from end-stage cervical cancer, pap smear is easy compared to that. That is a tough, tough deal. Symptoms, and again, most of these symptoms for most of these diseases are common with lots of things that aren't cancer. Bleeding after intercourse, 99.9% of the time has nothing to do with cervical cancer, but it is a symptom sometimes associated. But spotting between periods, rarely is that the reason. So I don't want you to go home if you've ever spotted in your life thinking you have cervical cancer. But these are some of the symptoms. Now, spotting after menopause, that's significant. I'd check that right away. But if you spotted mid-cycle once in the past 5 years, I probably would just go for my regular annual checkup whenever that was and not worry much about it. And most of the discharges, the vaginal discharges, whether they are watery, foul, thick, white, all of those kind of things are almost never related to cervical cancer. But if you have one that doesn't go away, that you've treated with everything in the pharmacy, then leave the pharmacy, go to the doctor, and get a pap smear and see what's going on. We talked about the sexual activity. That's just the statistics. I know that you minister to a lot of ladies, and some of you deal with youth groups. This kind of information never scares anybody out of premarital sex, but you ought to know it because it's a risk that's out there. Will condoms protect you from HPV? Kind of, sort of, better than nothing, but no. Because, first of all, teenagers don't use them right. They don't use them always, and they break. And the virus is actually quite small, and some have suggested that certainly the HIV can penetrate it. Maybe the HPV can, too. In any case, This is a risk that we will face in our generation. And not everyone with abnormal pap smears has had HPV, okay? Lots of folks can have that, have the abnormal paps. But if you have the papillomavirus history and an abnormal pap smear, that changes the risk, and it can be treated. And it can be treated and preserve your fertility if it's treated early. Once again, pap smears every year, even if every year means for you every other year, but regularly, all right? Colposcopy, I get asked about, it's basically binoculars so that we can magnify the cervix and see where the abnormal areas are so we can biopsy the part that doesn't look right. Find out if it's cancer, normal, or one of those in-betweens. Because the treatment protocol, and even cervical cancers are treatable if we catch them early enough. So I'm encouraging you not to put this off. The last cervical cancer I found was a lady that hadn't been to a doc in 5 years. I got to feel like if we'd have had one shot somewhere in between, we'd have found it, and then we could have treated it more effectively. There are lots of treatments. You can laser it, you can freeze it, you can burn it, you can cut it, you can do everything. You can get rid of it. You can treat cervical disease and keep the cervix functional. More than you wanted to know. All right, you don't need to know about staging. Let's talk ovaries briefly. Bad cancer, good cancer. Yeah, is there such a thing as a good cancer? Well, there's a whole spectrum. In ministry, we have to understand that cancer does not equal death. One of the first lessons in crisis class is cancer does not equal death. There are lots of different kinds. Some of them are just almost meaningless. There are lots of skin cancers that are that way. But there are some skin cancers that are quite devastating. Ovarian cancer is bad because it's hard to find. And we rarely find it early. And any cancer that we find late is obviously riskier, because once it starts to spread, then it's more dangerous. What is a cancer anyway? Yeah, these are cells that are growing without the normal limits. They don't know when to stop, so they just keep growing. Some of them keep growing in the same place and make a mass. Depending on where the mass is and what it pushes on, gives you your side effects. Others don't. They grow a little and then they, what we call metastasize. They sort of send out little satellites and they start growing in other places. And so they can implant all over. Obviously, if there's cancer and it's all in one lump, it's easy to correct surgically. You just take out the lump. But once it's shotgunned everywhere, then surgery doesn't get it. And so you have to figure out how are you going to get to all of those other cells that are growing not normal. And how do we do it? Chemo gets to everywhere. Radiation, depending on the dose, we can get to lots of places. And sometimes we use combinations of things. So ovarian cancer is important. It's one of the common ones. It's hard to find. And if we find it early, that's stage one, confined to the ovary, 90% five-year survival. That's pretty good. How do you find a cancer early in the ovary? You're going to need to have a good examination by a competent physician and perhaps a sonogram. Sometimes the sonogram can help us a lot to image those, but you have to do that by feel because the ovary starts to get bigger or it gets hard in one place or it gets cystic. And what's a cyst? Fluid-filled sac. So just because you have a cyst, as a matter of fact, all of you that are ovulating still, every month at mid-cycle, you have a cyst. It's 2 centimeters, about 1 inch in diameter. The egg is within that. That cyst ruptures and the egg is released. Perfectly normal. So that if you are examined at mid-cycle, your ovary is going to be bigger and more tender because of this cyst that's about to ovulate. That's not cancer. What you're looking for is something that's grown and is big and stays and is there on the ovary when it's not supposed to be there. You look at it on the sonogram and it's there. You look at it again after a period and it's still there. And its size matters. Solid or cystic matters. But the only way to find these early is to be vigilant in your preventive checkups. The symptoms I put in red because how many of you have had abdominal swelling, bloating, pain, pressure? I've had that. And I'm guessing the chances of my having ovarian cancer are fairly remote. You see, those symptoms don't help you very much. Urinary frequency? Give me a break. I mean, you know, that's just weight change. Oh, yeah, that's helpful. You see, the weight can go down sometimes because of the cancer, or it can cause fluid retention so it can go up, so you don't know. So what you really need is just a regular checkup with somebody who knows you and is careful about you. Sometimes ovarian cancer will give abnormal bleeding, but 98% of the time, abnormal bleeding is related to hormones, has nothing at all to do with ovarian cancer. But I want to put in the back of your mind, particularly, not so much the 20s, pretty rare, occasional, 30s, not too often, 40s some, 50s and up, it becomes more and more of an issue. Family history of ovarian cancer is significant. Age, we talked about. Childbearing. Does having babies make it better or worse as far as ovarian cancer? I think I heard better, and it does. Having children and nursing actually lowers your risk of ovarian cancer and breast cancer. Now, not everyone can have babies. Not everyone is that an opportunity for them, but statistically, it makes a difference. Now, infertility, depending on whose study you read, some of the medicines that we use are implicated that may increase the risk. I think that's still up for grabs. But if you are someone who is on Clomid for a long time or Pergonol for infertility, you would be wise for your lifespan to be checked. But I think everybody should be checked. I think you should keep track of yourself. I think I should keep track of myself. I show a cyst. Can you see it? Not hardly. This little fluid-filled sac is a cyst. Perfectly benign. That's a follicle cyst. There's lots of things on the ovary that aren't cancer. All right? Because there's an ovarian mass or there's a lump and they want to do more testing, does not equal cancer. But it just means, well, something's there that doesn't look or feel right. Let's test it further. These are all the kinds of cysts that are perfectly benign. Some of them are interesting. The endometrioma is the result of endometriosis. You know what that is? Some of you do, okay. Well, the endometrium is the tissue that lines the inside of the uterus, okay? Picture the uterus again. Well, out through the tubes. Some think it goes through the bloodstream, others through the lymph system, and that tissue gets on the ovary or somewhere else. It grows, but it doesn't have any place to go. We call that endometriosis. But if it collects in a lump and it swells into a fluid-filled cyst, it's called an endometrioma. They are benign, but they cause all the same pressure symptoms and pain symptoms. They may be very suspicious for ovarian cancer. So because you have a lump doesn't mean you have cancer, okay? Our take-home message for tonight. There are lots of different lumps that are perfectly benign, but ovarian cancer is a scary one and worth being checked for. Pelvic examination is the key. Regular check to find out that this is normal size for you. And there should be someone in this world that knows that. Pelvic sonogram, very nice, because we can measure now with great accuracy what the ovary looks like. How big is it? Has it got cysts in it? Has it got solid stuff in it? Anything to be worried about. The CT scan, the computerized tomography, is just basically x-rays that the computer can fix for us and give us beautiful resolution. We can see all sorts of cool stuff. Now the magnetic resonance imagery doesn't use x-ray at all. It uses the body's own magnetic field and the difference between cell lines, and we can get great pictures that way. Doesn't hurt, but it can be expensive for sure, and insurance may not cover it, but we can see a lot of things to resolve. Is this suspicious and needs surgery? Is this benign? We can just watch it and leave it alone. But ovary is significant. There's some blood markers that can help, but there's not a blood test that says, yes, you have it, no, you don't. I think we're heading to a place where there's a series of blood tests that if you put them all together, we'll know that your risk is very high or your risk is very low. That may be as close as we get for a while. It'd be nice if there was something, you know, like a pregnancy test. If that hormone is up, you got this. It's not that way with ovarian cancer. Birth control pills, what's the risk factor of using oral contraceptives and ovarian cancer? It's an interesting phenomenon, but it's decreased. Women who've taken the pill for over 5 years, and it doesn't have to be consecutive, have lower risk of ovarian cancer. So does that mean women should be on oral contraceptive? No, I'm just telling you the statistics as far as that goes. Because oral contraceptives at the moment are quite the point of debate. And I don't have time to explain that, but one of these days we will. I've written something to hand out because I get asked that a lot. Pregnancy and breastfeeding, as we said, decreases the risk. Hysterectomy, if you take out the ovaries, obviously eliminates the risk, except there's a kind of cancer that's very similar to the ovary that can spring up even if your ovaries have been removed. So what is the take-home lesson of all this stuff? Yeah, take care of yourself. There's some things that you can check by yourself. There's some things that you need some help. Diabetes is a huge issue because lots of people have it. Basically, all of us have blood sugar circulating. Insulin is what takes the blood sugar from the bloodstream and puts it in the cells where it belongs. If you don't have enough insulin made from your pancreas, you will have elevated blood sugar because it won't be going where it's supposed to go. And that, over time, can cause significant effects to every organ in your body. So having normal blood sugar is important. Now, that doesn't mean that your blood sugar should be normal right after you knock down a 16-ounce Coke. It will be high then, but it should come back to normal. There are types. If you're interested in that, if you've got a family history, would be important for you to understand. But as time wraps up for us, let me just put these on there, because there are some symptoms that are significant in early diabetes. If you have no family history, but you find yourself drinking all the time, like you've seen me tonight, now that wouldn't be it, but that desire to drink all the time, eat all the time, your weight's going down even though you wait all the time or eat all the time, you have to go to the bathroom all the time, which sort of fits if you drink all the time, may be diabetes. May just be that you're a person that likes a lot of water. But how do you check to see if you're diabetic? One way is the finger stick. I know nobody likes to get their finger punctured, and fasting is better than after you've eaten, but if we can figure out how much you've eaten, we can figure out about where your blood sugar should be. And if you flunk that test, then we could do a fasting one. But blood sugar and having diabetes is serious because it affects everything. The nerves, your kidneys, the eyes, your heart. All of those things are affected by blood sugar out of control. Now, if you are diabetic and your blood sugar stays in good control, these things don't have to happen. Good controlled blood sugar folks can live long and very productive lives. It's folks that don't take care of themselves that have a myriad of complications. And I'm sure many of you have had relatives that have either managed their cases aggressively or less so. Obviously, we're talking about pretty aggressive approach to your health tonight. That is dietary things. That doesn't mean you can't ever eat what you like. It just means there is some moderation involved. Exercise can mean for you just walking, but it means some activity. Some with diabetes do need medications. Some are insulin, some are oral. With some of the stem cell research, particularly adult stem cell, which I like, as opposed to embryonic, which I don't, may one day be able to replace those pancreatic cells that aren't functioning well. So there's lots on the horizon medically to encourage you, but let me, as we conclude tonight, just suggest that your health is worth it, and that some of these things are very simple to do. And we have for you a table that has some pamphlets. I think there's some vitamin stuff. Now, I haven't mentioned that. Do you need vitamins? I think if you eat perfectly, you don't. I don't know anybody that does, so you might consider a good multi. I do. If you're considering a pregnancy, there are certain vitamins, B vitamins, that if you take before you get pregnant, you decrease the risk of spina bifida, some other things. There's just some things you can do for your health that help the design, that you were designed to be active and functional. And your genetics may put you in some of these categories of risk, but that doesn't mean you are helpless. That means there are some things that if you take control and manage aggressively your care, you may not have to be one of those bad statistics, because all of those things found early can be managed fairly effectively. So let me turn the program back over, and I'll hang around a little bit by the table if there's anything specific that you had for me. And again, I thank you for your time and your attention, and we'll just quit there.